When I was a kid, well, I guess when I was a teenager, and probably many of you about the same time as I was a teenager were teenagers or a little older, a little younger, as the case may be, but there was a song that was very popular. And it was, I'm sure it was a number one hit. You heard it all the time on the radio. And it's interesting because I was reading the words to this song a while back, and it made me realize how often we hear a song on the radio or we find ourselves singing a song and we don't even think about what the words say. It's amazing how you can hear a song hundreds and hundreds of times, and you couldn't, if somebody said, would you tell me what those, read those words out, and you don't know because you don't focus in on it, and sometimes that can be a problem. But this particular song was by a group called the Rolling Stones, and the song was entitled I Can't Get No Satisfaction. And I remember that song, hearing it. It wasn't one of my favorite, really, but it was just something I'd hear a lot. And I wrote down the words because I wanted to speak on a subject that this particular song that they sang deals with. And I'll just read the first couple of verses here of the song. It says, I can't get no satisfaction. Well, that's kind of interesting, isn't it, because that's the name of the song. But it started off that way. It says, because I try and I try and I try and I try and I can't get no, I can't get no. I won't sing it. I'll just read it. I'm trying to be merciful to you. It says, when I'm driving in my car and a man comes on the radio, he tells me more and more about some useless information supposed to fire my imagination. I can't get no, oh, no, no, no. Hey, hey, hey. That's the song. I'm not singing. Hey, hey, hey. Well, that's what I say. I can't get no satisfaction. Now, when I'm watching my TV and a man comes on and tells me how white my shirt should be, well, he can't be a man because he doesn't smoke the same cigarettes as me. I can't get no satisfaction. Now, I never really thought about what those words said, and it was kind of interesting when I looked it up, but, you know, I kind of liked the way the song sounded, but I didn't really think a whole lot about it. I do remember the Super Bowl 2 or 3, 4 years ago when the Rolling Stones were on the Super Bowl, and that at the halftime entertainment, and that Mick Jagger was dancing around, and I thought he is going to be in bed for a couple of days because in no way a 70-year-old man, which he is now, is going to do all those splits and dancing around without feeling kind of sore the next day. I guess I'm thinking about when Penny and I went over to my mother's and she's putting in a bigger porch. And I was going to put the concrete, and so we offered to go over and cut out the bushes and get everything ready. My sister and Penny and I did it, and my word, was I sore the next day. And all we did was dig up. There was one bush that every time I'd cut a root, there would be another one. I'm thinking, my word, what? You don't care, I know, but and I don't even know why I brought it up. I just started feeling sore thinking about it, though. But Penny was really working hard there. She's a hard worker. She's wiry. But that song, here's the point. That song expresses a deep dissatisfaction with life. A deep dissatisfaction with life, as if nothing is going right. In fact, I looked at my notes and I said that it says that song expresses a deep satisfaction with life. And, of course, I printed that out wrong. A deep dissatisfaction of life. And I guess you could say it's the exact opposite of being thankful and contented. Now, we live in a hard world. Well, anybody that says this is an easy world it's just not, is it? It's a hard world. As you get older, you have health issues. Sometimes when you're young, you have health issues, and you have just all types of issues in life. And we look on television, and we see things that do not seem right, mainly because they're not right. And we hear people tell us things, leaders and so forth in the world, and we know that that may not doesn't really jive with what we know, and sometimes we know it's totally not true. But the question I want to ask today is, where do you and where do I fit in this question of how satisfied are we with life? Because, again, if you are happy with the way everything is going on in this world, then you're not. Because we know that things are not the way they should be in many cases, but that doesn't need to affect our outlook on the big picture, because there is a bigger picture than just this world as we see it. Now, I think the last time I was here, I think I spoke on Solomon here 2 weeks ago, and Solomon exemplified a man that had more than any person in the world. I mean, he had everything, and you know, we went through all the various things that Solomon had materially and all the wisdom that God gave him and how he squandered it sometimes. But Solomon still had deep discontentment, and the letter of Ecclesiastes talks about it. The whole 12 chapters of Ecclesiastes is written by Solomon late in his life, and he expressed all types of deep dissatisfaction, because all those things weren't making him happy. All those things that he had materially didn't solve all the other issues in life. Now, 1 Kings chapter 11, and again, we went over Solomon last time, so we're not going to really go back there, except I want to mention just a couple of scriptures. The first one, I think I read a little bit of this, maybe all of it last time, but in 1 Kings 11, verse 1 through 4, and it's talking about all the wives that Solomon had. And it says, "But King Solomon loved many foreign women, as well as the daughter of Pharaoh, women of the Moabites, Ammonites, Edomites, Sidonians, and Hittites, and from the nations of whom the Lord had said to him, and said to the children of Israel, do not intermarry with them." Why did he say it? And he answers it right here. "Nor with you, for surely they will turn away your heart after their gods." They would turn him away from the true God to these false things that people seem to think are good. And false religion and false all the various and such things. I saw where, you probably did too, and at first I thought this must not be in the United States, but then I found out it was. And on September 11th this year, 9/11, they are trying to schedule a 1 million man woman march of Muslims in Washington to protest that we need to quit blaming them for what happened on 9/11 how many years ago. And I'm thinking, what's going on here? You know, we're supposed to. Yes, thankfully we live in a country that's freedom of religion. But where's the freedom? Where's the freedom of Christianity and people there? But we're supposed to, now we're supposed to be apologizing for a religion where the fanatics in that religion killed all these people, and look at all the stuff that's going on in the world. We're supposed to be one apologizing? And there's supposed to be a march? And I'm thinking, and I heard President Obama a couple days ago talking about what's going on in Egypt, and they are burning Christian. You know, they don't always know, you know, these Christian, you know, the word Christian, it doesn't mean that everything, they've got the truth in many cases, or maybe all the cases probably, but over there. But they're burning these churches, and nobody seems to care. And in his little speech was an answer, I guess it was a statement, went on for about 5 minutes. He kind of obliquely in there said something about, yes, need to stop burning churches, or stop destroying churches. But he didn't say anything about Christian or what, you know, is listed as Christian church. It's like we're supposed to just take it, and yet, like I say, Solomon was told not to marry women that would turn him away from the true God. And we are told to take a look at what the true God is, and when we turn away to other things, it's not going to go well. It never goes well. It never, ever goes well when we go against what God tells us to do. And he said, and then, of course, here's the scripture of scriptures, which is it's bizarre. He had 700 wives, princesses, and 300 concubines, and his wives turned away his heart. Well, I guess so. He's dealing with 1,000. I guess they would kind of get him kind of confused. But what was he doing? How was he treating them? I mean, just bizarre. Bizarre. For it was so when Solomon was old. So here is what happened. When he was old, that his wives turned away his heart to other gods. And his heart was not loyal to the Lord his God, the one that he asked for wisdom, and he gave him wisdom. And remember, God said, I'm giving you more wisdom than any man has ever had. And yet, wow, it doesn't look like he used a lot of wisdom here. He had it, but he didn't use it. And then, of course, we read the letter of the book of Ecclesiastes, where he laments all these foolish things he'd done in his life and said it's all just a big load of vanity. All these things that seem so important to him, material things, like whoever has the most toys wins, you know, type of thing, as they say. It's just a big pile of vanity. But then he said in Ecclesiastes chapter 9, and of course, I encourage you to read the entire book of Ecclesiastes, but Ecclesiastes 9, he makes a statement. Here is, I assume, is the words of a man who had seen it all. Who had seen it all. In verse 3 of Ecclesiastes 9, he says, this is an evil in all that is done under the sun, that one thing happens to all. He said, truly the hearts of the sons of men are full of evil. Madness is in their hearts. Look at what's going on in this world and you say, this is madness. This is madness. We had our president talk about the other day about how he's taking care of all this NSA and all these leaks and so forth, and that's going to be taken care of, and he's going to put together this select panel that's going to study into all this and correct all this, and then he appoints the man, James Clapper, the one that lied to Congress, to be over this. And then yesterday they announced that in 2012, there were 2,772, I believe it was, or 2,776, I can't remember exactly which, but of cases that have proven where the NSA overstepped the law. Madness is in the hearts. I mean, this world is maddening at times. And yet, we get caught up in it, don't we? At times. It says, while they live, madness is in their hearts, and after that, they go to the dead. They die. And every physical human being dies. And yet, many human beings think, what's going to happen after I die? They've got all these things, all these theories, and you look at all the theories. I mean, if you're a Hindu, you might see the bug walking down the... If there was a bug walking down the... There's my Uncle Joe walking down the... And that's madness. That's crazy. But that's what Uncle Joe must not have lived a very good life if he's a bug. But yet that passes for knowledge. He says, but for him who is joined to all... As long as you're alive, there's hope. But for a living dog is better than a dead lion. In other words, is that what it's all about? Now, if a person can't get satisfaction they're seeking of, what do most people do? Now, you know the answer to this. This isn't a trick question. But when I am not happy or not satisfied, and when any, you name it, when we're not satisfied, what do most people do? They complain. Now, I would like to say I never complain. But then I don't want to hear lightning and thunderbolts, you know, going on all around, because we all complain. And look at the Israelites. All they did was complain. They were mad at Moses all the time, and eventually they were going to replace a leader to take them back to Egypt, where they were slaves before. Now, I worked at a grocery store, H.G. Hill's, when I was in high school, and I think part of college, maybe summer or so, but H.G. Hill's was a grocery store in Nashville, and I worked there, and I worked in all these various and sundry different departments at H.G. Hill's, and I actually enjoyed working in a grocery store. I've always sort of enjoyed it, but there was a man, I still remember to this day, that worked there. He was probably, I thought of him as really old. I thought of him as ancient, actually, and probably younger than I am now. But he seemed so old. His name was Mr. Marbury. And the thing I remember about Mr. Marbury is he never was happy about anything. He complained and he cussed all the time and just griped and complained about everything. Constantly complained was Mr. Marbury. In fact, one thing I remember about him, about his career as anything, is one day he was nice to me. And I thought, wow, what got into him? He's actually nice today. But Mr. Marbury, I came to work one day, and he wasn't there. And I asked somebody, I said, where is he? And they said he died over the weekend. And, you know, nobody seemed to care. It's like, okay, well, Mr. Marbury died. Let's go stock the shelves. Let's go weigh the produce. Let's go sack the groceries. But nobody really seemed to care. Now, I have a question to ask, and I'll ask me and I'll ask you, and that is, how many times a day do you complain? Now, I've never put a meter on it. I, you know, how do you do it? But there was a book by a man named Hal Urban. The name of the book was Life's Greatest Lessons. But he made a statement here. He was an educator. He taught high school and college classes. And he says, he asked the question, how often do you complain a day? And he says, if you're anything like my students, both in high school and university, the number's quite high. And he says, I'm not criticizing the students. He says, I'm just noting the way things are. Now, he would do an experiment every year. He said for 18 years, he would do this experiment in school. And what he would do, he would call all the students together, and he would sit them down, and he would give them a class assignment. And the class assignment was to tell them for the next 24 hours, try to go without complaining even once. Just make it a note. And he said, don't worry, if you make a mistake, then just say, okay, I complain. Let me move forward and see if we can make it a day without complaining. And he says, you know what the first response was? Complaining about the assignment. Oh, no, this is awful. But he said, that's the first thing I do is complain. But he said he would encourage them not to stop if they found they complained or made a mistake and so forth, but to just write down every time you notice that you complain for 24 hours. He also asked them, if they complain, to consider why and try to write down why they complain. Now, the next day, he said he would ask the class, which would normally number around 30 people, he asked them to predict how many people in that class of around 30 went 24 hours without complaining. He said usually the answer, they'd say between 6 and 12 or so forth, they would figure didn't complain. But he said he always wrote down a number, and he said after they all analyzed things, he said the answer was zero. He said in 18 years, I never once had a student that was able to say, honestly, they never complain once in a 24-hour period. And, you know, again, oftentimes I'm just talking and not really thinking about it, but it's so easy, isn't it? It's so easy to complain and not even think about it. And I look in something, we read about the Israelites and all the complaints they did when they were, you know, and you think, what is their problem? And I'm thinking, well, maybe I'm a lot like them. Or maybe sometimes we're a lot more like them than we want to think we are. Now, Urban, who wrote this book, he said the best part of the experiment came in the discussions afterwards. You know, after they were determined that they all had complained, at least once, he said he would ask them two simple questions. He would say, number one, what do you think was the purpose of the assignment? And they would usually answer something like they wanted, the assignment was to show us how much we complain, which was correct. But he'd say the second question he'd ask is, what did you learn from trying this out? What did you learn from this experiment? And they would answer and say, we really realize that we really don't have all that much to complain about, even though we complain a lot. He says, we used to complain about stupid stuff. They said, we're usually aren't complaining about really the deep things, you know, but stupid stuff. So it's something to think about. something to think about. Now, where do we go in God's Word to take a look at this subject? And I think the place to go is 1 Timothy chapter 6, verse 6. 1 Timothy chapter 6, verse 6. Because this talks about exactly what I've been talking about here at the first. 1 Timothy 6, verse 6. The words of the Apostle Paul says, "But godliness with contentment is great gain." Now that's, you know, how many words is that? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 or 8 words. But godliness with contentment is great gain. Now, if you look up, you know, if you look at the Greek word, I guess you could say, you know, that's not always that big a deal what the Greek word is, but they mean things. And the Greek word for godliness, it's spelled E-U-P-E-P-S-I-A, for what it's worth. Euphusia, I think, is the way you pronounce it. But it signifies true religion, Christianity, God's way of life. In other passages, the word godliness is translated in different ways. But the basic definition is of godliness here is God-likeness or likeness to God. Being like God. Now, we all know that we fall short because we're human beings. But being like God is great gain. Contentment comes from living God's way and thinking God's way. And I had a little quote here from this Bible Illustrator. It says, "Discontent always springs from pride and overweening conceit of our own value and excellence. We are all by nature high-minded and esteem ourselves at more than we may even be worth. But God sees us a lot higher than we see ourselves. That's the amazing part. Even though we may see ourselves in ways, we also have all these thoughts and doubts and concerns. But God sees us as so much higher than we even see ourselves and so much more potential than we see ourselves. But remember what I read, but godliness with contentment is great gain. It's not only God being like God, it's godliness with contentment. Now, contentment, the Greek word here, it's A-U-T-A-R-K-E-I-A, but it's the definition is a competency, a sufficiency, and satisfied feeling of freedom from murmuring and complaining. The definition in the Greek dictionary of contentment is a calm and satisfied feeling of freedom from murmuring and complaining. So let's think about that. Being like God, godliness with being satisfied, it's a great gain for people. Now, when I first started keeping the Sabbath, it was 1972, and I'd work all week and I'd go home. And on Friday night, I lived in a one-bedroom apartment by myself. And when I'd go home, I would just feel so, it was a feeling I've never really, I can still remember it now because I never stopped going. You know, I didn't, you know, it's 7 days a week. Just go, 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 go. And I remember my boss used to call me and try to get me to go play golf on Saturday. And I'd say, no, I'm going to church. And I'd explain it to him, and he'd do it again and do it again. It's like I couldn't ever figure out why he just didn't remember or was trying to tell. I couldn't. But it would be so relaxing just to be sitting at home on Friday night with nothing to do, with no work to worry about, with no paperwork, with no phone calls to call about work. It was an amazing feeling when I first started rest stopping and just stopping from all the day, the labor. Okay, I read 1 Timothy 6, verse 6, but it doesn't end there. Let's take a look at this scripture here, because let's take a look at, I put a title here, Godliness with Contentment. Godliness with contentment, it says, is great gain. But then notice what the next words of Paul say. He says, "For we brought nothing into this world." I mean, let's think about it. When we were born, what did we bring in? Nothing. We were born by a miracle of God. God created us. You know, our parents conceived us, and God allowed us to be born. We did nothing to deserve that in and of ourselves. It's not because God said, oh, this person is going to be so perfect. The fact of just life itself is an amazing thing. So it says, we brought nothing into this world, and it is certain we can carry nothing out. You know, those pharaohs used to put all those different things in their tombs and all those things and what they're going to do in the afterlife. But when they discovered the tombs, all those riches of the pharaohs were just sitting there in the tomb. We brought nothing into this world. It's certain we can carry nothing out. And yet so many people think that's the end of it. But that's not what God says, is it? Then he says, and having food and clothing, with these we shall be content. Now, it's not that we're not to improve ourselves. That's not the point. But God says, or Paul says through here, says, when you got food, when you got clothes, we're a whole lot above some people. We're a whole lot above some that never even have virtually anything. And yet we live in a country that even the poorest of us, the government will give us substance to eat and to live. But those who desire to be rich. Now, everybody would like to have more money. That's not the point. Everybody would like to have a little bit more. But if our all-consuming passion is about getting, 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 no matter who we hurt, no matter who we lie about, no matter who we step over. And I've seen people like that, and you have too, that they'll do anything to get their way. They'll lie, they'll cheat, they'll steal to get whatever they want, not worrying about who they may be hurting. And it says, but those who desire to be rich fall into temptation and a snare and into many foolish and harmful lusts, which drown men and women, of course, in destruction and perdition. A lot to think about there. Remember, it all started off God. If we can be God-like and content with what God's given us, not that we don't want to improve ourselves, not that we don't want to become. How many people don't care about improving themselves? God wants us to try to improve ourselves. But he says, be thankful for what we have. We didn't bring anything to this world. We didn't do anything to cause us to have to create us. We certainly, when we die, except for the resurrection, except for the mercy of God, except for God's great resurrection, we would never, ever live again. It'd just all be over. But God says it's not over. He says if we desire to have all these things, all these riches and all these things, we start concentrating. Remember how Solomon started concentrating on all these things, all these wives, all this money, all these things. It didn't make him happy. He said it didn't solve the problem. It didn't make him content. In the end, he says, for the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil. How many people today in this world, all the stock market and all the stuff, they're jimmying things around to get things unfairly and cheating and whatnot. It's a sad situation. The love of money is the root of all kinds of evil, for which some, because of love of money, because of just grasping for things that there's not really theirs, some have strayed even from the faith, from God's way of life. How? In their greediness. They needed those things. They needed those things, and they've even turned away from God's truth. And they pierced themselves through with many sorrows. In the end, it didn't make them happy. Again, the point is not to improve ourselves, and we all wish we had, you know, if somebody said, hey, I want to give you some money, I wouldn't turn it down. But how content are we that we have the blessings we do have? Now, there's a true story about a simple Quaker. Simple living Quaker. He was watching his neighbor move in next door. And his neighbor, he said, had all these furnishings. Now, when Penny and I were looking for a house, not in Knoxville, but in Chattanooga, we looked at several houses in this area, what we thought we could afford. Well, you can never afford it, can you? That's why we take out loans on houses. But But we were looking at, but there was one house we called the Boathouse, and we narrowed it down to three houses. And this Boathouse, we originally called the Boathouse, it had everything. And we saw the photos of the man and woman that lived there. They looked like they were in their 20s or maybe 30s, and they had a boat in the garage. They had the highest tech workout system, all types of electronic TVs, gadgets. Their bed was one of the most expensive beds I've ever seen. I thought, man, their bed was, they had everything. I thought, where do they get all the money for this? And more than likely, they were in a lot of financial difficulties, I would suspect, but of course, we'll never know. We didn't buy the Boathouse. But we went there, I think, two or three times, and I was just fascinated by all the things they had, and that's why I thought it was so. And then I opened the garage, and there was this giant boat in there after all the other stuff. I thought, my word, how much did that cost? But this simple living Quaker who was watching his new neighbor move in with all the furnishing, expensive toys and gadgets that successful people collect. It said the Quaker finally went over to his new neighbor to introduce himself, and he said, "Neighbor, if you ever need anything, come over and see me, and I will tell you how to get along without it." Because some of the things they really didn't need. Again, it's not that it's not good to have things, but they had all this stuff because they thought they needed it. Now, there was an author who lived in the 1800s named Henry David Thoreau, and he made a statement. He reminded in one of his books, he said, "A man is wealthy in proportion to the number of things he can afford to do without." Of course, a man or a woman. He said they're wealthy in proportion to the number of things they can learn to live without. And again, I read those who desire to be rich, verse 9, 1 Timothy 6, they fall into temptation and a snare. You know, they've got to have this, and so easy to twist things around and lie and cheat and steal and do whatever. Cheat on your income tax, you name it. They can fall into many foolish and harmful things. Can drown them. Love of money can cause all kind of evil and cause even people to leave God's way. Now, continuing, 1 Timothy 6, verse 11. Here is what Paul, after he had said these things to Timothy, here is what he told Timothy to do. He said, "But you, O man of God," so he loved Timothy, saw Timothy as a man of God. He said, "You, O man of God, flee these things. Flee these things and pursue righteousness, godliness, faith, love, patience, and gentleness." These are things that don't really pop out, you know, pop your eyeballs out and say, "Yeah, that's what I want. I want more patience. I want more gentleness. I want more righteousness, godliness, faith, love." I mean, they seem so abstract, don't they? But Paul said, "Timothy, this is what you need to pursue. This is what you need to be thinking about." Hebrews chapter 13. Again, I'm not in any way saying we don't want to improve ourselves. Of course we do. But we can become so obsessed with things that we can't ever be happy if we don't get all the things. In Hebrews 13, verse 5, says, "Let your conduct be without covetousness," coveting, having to have more and more, "and be content with such things as you have." Well, it's easy to say that. It's not that hard to do sometimes. "Be content with such things as you have, for God said, I will never leave you, and I'll never forsake you." So we may boldly say, "The Lord is my helper. I will not fear. What can man do to me?" Now, there was a World War I pilot named Eddie Rickenbacker. If you've read any history, you've probably heard of him. And sometimes going without can be a great teacher. He was shot down in World War One out of his plane, and he said he drifted in a life raft for 21 days in the Pacific Ocean, hopelessly lost. And you know, it's all that water, but it was salt water. He couldn't drink it. And he was out there, and I think he had a few supplies and a few things, but he was running out of things. And he survived for 21 days. He was finally rescued when, who knows, if he thought maybe he would never be rescued. And he said he learned a lesson, and they asked him, they said, what was the biggest lesson you learned? And he said, the biggest lesson I learned from that experience of being 21 days in a life raft in the Pacific Ocean was that if you have all the fresh water you want to drink and all the food you want to eat, you should never complain about anything. He had to go through some pretty hard things to see that, man, how fortunate he was. In short, I think it's safe to say, and I look at myself over the years, but complaining can become a way of life. Complaining can become obsession. We all know people that they just complain about everything. One person I'm thinking of that you probably don't know them, but they're not here or even in churches up here, but every time they ever call, they would complain. I know this one woman was at a church area in another state even, and she was complaining about things constantly, about how nobody cared about her and nobody would do anything for her. And I remember the church actually took up a collection just to help her out, and it was over $1,000. And within a week or so, she was complaining again about nobody cared about her. And I remember somebody had to, I think a lady had a baby or was in the hospital. I can't remember all the details, but the other ladies were asking the ladies in church if they could make a dinner for this lady that was in the hospital. And like I said, I think she just had a baby or had some type of surgery. And this lady came up to me after before church, as soon as I got there, the one that was always complaining, and she came up and said, they asked me to make a meal. Don't they realize I've got a job? I don't have time for stuff like that. And I thought, my word. I didn't know what to say. I honestly didn't know what to say because I thought, people are trying to help you out and you don't have time to make a meal for somebody? It's amazing. It says God will never leave us. God will never forsake us. It says be content. And again, we all have trials. I know that. And some of us have more than others, and in whatever way we can, we need to try to help each other in our trials. But it's a tough world. We need God's kingdom. And there's a lot to be concerned about. But God says, look to the positive in so many ways. Proverbs chapter 30. Proverbs chapter 30. I didn't bring my watch, and this is a short sermon because I think I don't have much left, but I don't think the point is how long the sermon is. It's just something for each of us, including myself, maybe more so myself than anyone, to think about. The blessings God gives us, just the fact that we live in this country. We could have been born anywhere. We could have not been born. But God was merciful and so merciful and so good and has so much in store and so many plans for each of us and each human being that He's ever created. He has a plan. He wants us to succeed. Proverbs 30, verse 8, said, remove falsehood and lies far from me. Give me neither poverty. You know, we don't want to be just destitute. Of course not. Who would? Give me neither poverty nor riches. Is it good to be one of the Kardashians? Feed me with the food you prescribe for me. Why? Lest I be full and deny you. And say, who is the Lord? I don't need anything. We used to, I may have said this before. I may have said this last time I was here, but I remember saying it somewhere. But when I was in California, attending church there, lived in a place called La Crescenta. And in our church area, there was Glendale, there was Tahunga, Sunland, Northridge, Van Nuys, all these names, not that well-known, not that famous. But in our church area was also Beverly Hills. Now, you've heard of Beverly Hills. We never got ever one visit request from Beverly Hills. But we sure got a lot from Sunland, Tahunga, Van Nuys. But never once did any, they didn't feel they needed it. I guess it's the only thing I can say. Give me neither poverty nor riches. Feed me with the food you prescribe for me, lest I be filled and deny you. And say, who's the Lord? Or lest I be poor and steal. See, that's a shame too. We're so, no one was helping. And profane the name of my God by stealing, by cheating, by lying. There's a girl I used to work with, a company I used to work for several years ago. And we were talking one day when we were driving around to an account. She was my, I can't remember what her title was, but she and I were talking, and we were down by Vanderbilt University. And I remember saying, Maria, I wonder if I died, if anybody would come to the funeral. And I'll never forget what she said. She said, I think you'd be surprised. And I don't know what that meant. That could be good or bad, couldn't it? I think you'd be surprised. She didn't say, oh, there'd be a lot of people. She just said, I think you'd be surprised. I remember going to a funeral. I don't know if I've told you this before, but I remember going, a man died in Nashville, and I didn't know the man. His wife went to church. I'd met him once, and he died. And I went over to the funeral home, and I don't know if I think it was supposed to be visitation, but I must have shown up when there was, it was not before the funeral. It was sort of before the viewing, or I don't know what. But he's walked in there, and there he was in a casket, and there was nobody there, just me and him. And I don't know why I thought this. I don't know why I even said it, but I remember I was there and I said, well, here we are. You and me. Nobody was there. One more scripture here. I think this is the last one. Yes. Philippians chapter 4. Verse 11, 12, and 13. Paul said, not that I speak in regard to need, for I have learned in whatever state I'm in to be content. And man, Paul went through a lot of hard times, didn't he? He says, I know how to be abased, and I know how to abound. Everywhere and in all things I have learned both to be full and to be hungry, both to abound and to suffer need. So Paul said, I had the good times, I've had the bad times. But he said, verse 13, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. Paul said he was content. Sure, he would like things. It's wonderful to get blessings and things and be thankful for them. But Paul said he looked at the big picture. So, if you can't seem to get no satisfaction, what's the remedy? I jotted down three things. No more scriptures, just 3 points. Number one, seek godliness that produces contentment, because that is a great gain. Seek godliness, and we read those scriptures. Seek godliness that produces contentment, because that is a great gain. Being developed into a genuine copy of Jesus Christ is the greatest privilege a human being can ever have. Working toward being more like Jesus Christ. You know, we're not there. We don't attain it in this life. But seek godliness, because that produces contentment, and that is a great gain. Number two, let's try to learn to abound in whatever physical condition you find yourself, there's always someone a whole lot worse off than you or me. There's always somebody worse off than us. And in a sense, however, we should never be content with our spiritual condition because it can always improve. Number three, if it comes about in the future that you and I are greatly diminished in our material circumstances, which it probably will, because our country financially may be saying things are going well, but it seems like we're on a precipice that's just a lot closer to problems than people want to admit. If it comes about that you and I are greatly diminished in our material circumstances, we need to never forget that we are God's people and He is performing a great work in us, and He will work things out. So in short, in all that we can be content that godliness will give us contentment. If we work toward godliness, and if we do those things, it will be a great gain.